Hey, welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Cogan. A lot of you have responded to that obituary that I wrote in Sunday's paper about the great Ken Nordine. There may never have been anybody in this market, and I'm including Studs Terkel in that, who has been a more influential radio voice. He was also the greatest voice ever. A new entry into the whole world of audio adventures is my friend Jeremy McCarter, who's sitting here, who drove in on this snowy night, who left his two kids at home to come in here tonight. He came to Chicago in 2014.
That's right.
For a variety of reasons, from the East Coast, where he collaborated on a book with Lin-Manuel Miranda, wrote another book called Young Radicals, has a lovely wife, and decided to come to Chicago because he has in-laws nearby who can help take care of the kids, basically. You've fallen in love with Chicago.
I have.
And its culture, and that has manifested itself in first something called the Make Believe Association, which I first encountered about a year, maybe a year and a half ago.
Yep.
It is now a podcast. Tell me about the seed of the Make Believe Association.
Sure. It's a couple of seeds sort of blended together. But Make Believe Association is a new nonprofit production company. You know, my background is in the live theater, but I've always loved radio, loved sound storytelling. And it occurred to me when I moved here and sort of caught the whiff of Chicago's cultural energy, which wants people to make new things, that
yeah,
it would
no
be fun
question.
To try to make something that is going to pull from the kind of theatrical storytelling that I love, but also take advantage of the fact that all of us are walking around with theaters in our ears now because of podcasts. And so Make Believe, what we try to do is we create audio dramas, which are like radio plays for podcast listeners. And then there's this civic piece to it, too, which is that I think that there's a way that stories create a crossroads where we can encounter each other and we can have a conversation about something beyond just the most horrible news of the last 12 hours, which is where we spend most of our time, right?
Well, I think the interesting thing is you described it to me before. Some theaters, all theaters maybe, have participated in what are called talkbacks at the end of various productions where it's like, yeah, I thought the guy who drove a cab should have been older. And that's not exactly what I'm into. It is a much more a wider kind of conversation about the meaning of the play and the meaning of various things. How have those gone so far?
They've been fantastic. I mean, when we do the tapings of these performances for the podcast, we do them for a small live audience. And when the actors are done doing what they do at their music stands, we take a little break and we come back. And then I go on stage, and if there's someone else wrote it, then I sit down with the person who wrote it, and we get the audience talking. And it is not a chance for the audience to sort of say whatever's on their minds and
right,
which
exactly.
performance they like.
I once was in a cab, and the driver was not nice. I mean, that's basically what you get a lot
right.
of these talk bags.
It really, I mean, a lot of forethought goes into the kind of conversation we want to have. And the goal is all of it, every aspect of the company is kind of a test to see how collaborative can we be? How can we make each other smarter and more creative? And that's certainly true in the collaborative way we write the scripts, which is in a writer's room situation. Obviously, the actors are collaborating with the director in rehearsals and in performance. And I want the people in those conversations to be trying to make each other smarter. And when the conversation really gets popping, which has happened a lot this season, that's the magic that happens.
Well, and that too is going to be available on the podcast.
It is, yeah. Yeah, so anyone who goes to makebelieve.fm to download one of the first two that we've put online so far, you'll get the performance, and then at the end you'll get some highlights of the conversations that we had.
The first season is four of these audio dramas.
Right, it's four full productions and then some other, some introductory things and trailers.
Sure. We're going to play some. Let's play. Let's give them a sample. Just a sample of that, the trailer thing. It's only a minute and 23 seconds, ladies and gentlemen, so stay tuned.
Once upon a time,
meaning like now,
a gifted group of storytelling artists came together at a crossroads.
Meaning Chicago.
They were actors, poets,
playwrights, composers, designers,
directors,
in Chicago.
And they produced a season of audio dramas,
which are like radio plays,
but without the radio,
sin radio,
titled
Grown Folks Fables.
programs in the season are new adaptations of old stories.
Stories drawn from the traditions of people in our city.
Why fables and folktales?
Because they've got everything.
Action.
Come, the orchards attract.
Comedia.
Oh, Taruga, it's a joke.
Dragons.
Dragones.
Each story,
cada historia,
every story is a crossroads.
Una encrucijada.
Different kinds of people find each other there.
That's why these audio dramas were recorded at live tapings.
In front of live audiences,
followed by very live conversations.
Yeah, all of us here identify.
We're familiar with.
Thought about a lot of things in experiencing the story.
Stories entertain.
They provoke.
They shape our world. If only we could see it.
Or hear it.
And all of it.
Todo. All of it.
All of it.
Is make-believe.
Subscribe to the podcast now.
You can do that at makebelieve.fm. That was a better conversation than you and I just had. given that that's produced and there's cool music behind it, but that really gives the answer. I have a couple more clips. I wanted to play Jeremy McCarter a couple, you know, sort of extended pieces from the first two that are available, Brava and Bro Rabbit.
Yeah.
It just doesn't. These are shows, ladies and gentlemen, that fly in the face of our short attention span world. These are shows to listen to. This is not something you can listen to it in a car, but this is not some quick hit. It's not a, you know, hi, here are the, and the way much of media is going, here are the top five reasons to listen to radio or something. These are full blown productions. What's the length?
They are all 40 or 45 minutes long. And then the conversation clip, so it looks longer than it is, but. But, you know, to me, it just feels like it's not, you know, you sit on your couch and turn on Netflix and it just kind of happens. Like, it does require a certain amount of attention. But to me, I mean, look, the thing I love about theater and why I've been involved with it for 20 years is because of that imaginative experience you get to have. Yeah. The actors give you a little and you supply the rest. And in a sense, like, an audio drama is that, but more so. Because
it also implies to me and begs attention listening, where you do set a time. And the great thing about podcasts is you can make that time anytime. You can make it 1:30 in the morning, 5:30 in the morning, 8:30 at night. It reminds me of the days when people used to gather around their radios, the family, Uncle Bernie from the attic. Drunk Uncle Bernie would come down and listen
Drunk
to the
Uncle
Lone
Bernie.
Ranger. Or to the vast variety of theatrical presentations on radio.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, look, there's something very, very essential to what it means to be a human being, that we sit around and share stories and talk about them. Like, if we didn't have the capacity for that, none of us would be here. And in a sense, like, what Make Believe is trying to do is to create a space where we can do that again.
But isn't part of it, too, and I may be wrong, but part of it is to create that a kind of community of listeners, too. Yeah. That the ideal thing is to listen to one of the four first season presentations with somebody else, because that, too, is a way that the conversation can extend beyond
exactly
the conversation that's available on there. We got to take a commercial break. We'll be back. We're talking all the way with Jeremy McCarter till 1:45, and then I'll let him go home to his family. It's makebelieve.fm. It's a great website. There are two of the four first season presentations up. Welcome back. I'm with Jeremy McCarter, who is, I don't know, the executive something, the creator of the Make Believe Association, which has launched its first audio drama, I think, in the middle of January, called Brava. Its second one shortly thereafter called Bra Rabbit. They are two audio theatrical adventures. They are recorded live. They feature a pretty big gathering of Chicago area talent. Not just the writers, but the producers, the sound people, all the
everybody,
the actors and actresses. There are two up now. Two more are coming very soon. I know you recorded them last year, but why put them? I don't know anything about podcasts, but four almost like back to back. You want to give everybody everything right away.
Yeah, we look, everything about the season is some form of experiment, right?
Sure.
And one of the things that is experimental is, well, what is the right tempo for releasing these things? And it just felt to us that that because there's so much carryover from one to the next in terms of the things that people are interested in talking about, that, well, let's just try to like roll them out and watch what happens. So two are up. The third one is The Lost Books of the Odyssey. That'll be out end of this month. And that is
written by you.
I did the adaptation of a novel that I really love from about 10 years ago by Zachary Mason. Same name. It's the series of riffs on the Odyssey. So it's inventive and funny. And so that one's end of February. And then the middle of March, this Lorraine Hansberry one act that basically no one ever does.
Yeah, why is
does.
That? Why is that?
Rick, I wish I knew, but it just doesn't get done much. It's called What Use Are Flowers? A Fable. She subtitled it A Fable. So yeah. Belongs in our season of Fables
Lorraine
and Folk
Hansberry,
Tales.
Of course, the ill-fated, die way too young author of A Raisin in the Sun.
Right.
And a Chicagoan, too. And a remarkable... Not just a remarkable woman, that whole story, it reminds me of, you know, Jonathan Larson and Rent and that tragic kind of end to it. Let's go back for a second, Jeremy McCarty, to the Rick Kogan notion of gathering around and listening to, you know, there are, I think the figure in this, I just wrote a piece about podcasts, there's something like 600,000 podcasts available right now. Something in that grotesque neighborhood. Many of them are nothing but ego parades for somebody who once was a very funny in third grade and remembers that he was told he was funny in third grade, or someone who has a wonderful idea about what we should do with government in the United States. Mm-hmm. I'm surprised there isn't a podcast called Build a Wall and then another one called Don't Build a Wall. Who knows?
I think it's pretty likely that both of those podcasts exist.
There's almost no question. There's almost no question. So you have to be pretty discriminating out there. But if you are, you can create a kind of audio world for yourself. There are some very good podcasts out there. I like Malcolm Gladwell's podcast. I think that's very smart. And now, makebelieve.fm to add to this, but to listen to it with... You know, I'm not saying have listening parties or gather, but just say, hey, why don't you and I, or why don't you and I and Betty and Louise get together and listen to this? Let's see what it's like.
Well, so part of the rationale from the very beginning was these stories are a way of bringing people together.
Yeah.
And it's tricky. There's this bottleneck because then we're releasing them on the internet, which is this alienating force in all of our lives. So here's a story. We decided, because, you know, of course we decided this, that we were going to throw a party on the eve of launching Brava, the first one we put online. So we had this party at the National Museum of Mexican Art. We had a lot of people sitting around. We decided that we would celebrate by listening to Brava. And so we announced we're going to do this listening party as our launch event. And it was only a couple of days after we decided this is what we're going to do that we kind of looked at each other like, what's a list? Like, what are we going to do? Yeah. Like, now we're going to have like 85, 90 people sitting around listening to something coming out of speakers. Like, what have we just set ourselves up for? And so we, you know, people sat on three sides. There was this little table in the center. We put some candles on the table to evoke the campfire where 100,000
years. The first
years.
Story, yes.
That's right.
Pre-Twitter, like, where the first story
most
were
of
told.
The stories humans have heard since there have been humans have been around a campfire, and it turned out it was fantastic. The experience of listening to a story with a group of people and then having the chance to talk about it afterwards. We had no formal talking thing set up after that. We just people sort of got up and stuck around for a long time. And so you said about a listening party. Look, I would love that. I mean, talk@makebelieve.fm is the email address for the company. We, after that night, it just made us feel like we have started doing more to encourage people to find ways, whether it's in their living rooms, whether it's in a more formal setting, listen to these things with other people, because we know as a society that we are losing our avenues for interacting with other people. This great book from 20 years ago, Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam.
Sure.
And, you know, our stories and listening parties going to fix what's wrong with the world? Not entirely, but if there were lots of people doing this, then it would start to spin things back in the right direction, I think.
That's very incredibly ambitious. Ernie, let's hear another thing, because I, as articulate and entertaining as Jeremy and I are, the stuff on the stuff on makebelieve.fm is even more so. Let's play that Why Talk About Stories.
I have this theory. We get stories all wrong. A lot of us think that movies and novels, plays and songs offer a break, a diversion from the serious work of the world. And they do. I mean, who could get through a day without those things? Who would want to? But even as we're entertained, those novels and movies and plays are making us think in certain ways and feel in certain ways. And if you believe science, then what we do every day is determined, at least in part, by the way that we think and feel. When we see little kids playing, pretending they're in some world they've invented, we call what they're doing make-believe. And we say it dismissively, as if make-believe doesn't matter. Well, I'd propose that make-believe, the songs, the stories, everything that creative artists create, that matters a lot. Make-believe moves us, provokes us, changes us, and in changing us, changes the world. Or it can, anyway, if you do it right. I'm Jeremy McCarter. I'm the founder and executive producer of Make Believe Association. It's a new production company based in Chicago. Mainly, we're going to produce audio dramas, plays for your ears. They're from great actors, writers, directors, and composers. And we'll give audiences a chance to talk about them, to see if we can figure out together what those stories mean. The chance to talk with people that way, that's not as common as it ought to be.
Exactly. It is. It may seem, sound redundant to you what Jeremy just said there, because we've been talking about it, but you need to know that. The other thing, the one thing you don't mention in that, and I've listened to both of the first two, is these things are quite, quite entertaining. I mean, I don't want to dismiss that or give people the idea that this is some kind of, you know, a philosophy seminar at Yale or something. Right. It is far, far from it.
Yeah, I mean, I've always said this. I've said this to all my collaborators in the company, and you know, the reason to do it is because it's a good time. Because
absolutely.
The stories are funny,
no
and
question.
Suspenseful and sad, and if that doesn't happen, then the other stuff doesn't matter.
Can't happen.
And that's what we push for. You know, like I said, we developed the scripts in a writer's room, and the challenge was not to make it profound. The challenge was make it exciting, make it funny.
And this was last year, and you sat in that in that room with Nate Marshall, who is the credited as the author of Br'er Rabbit, which is based on Br'er Rabbit, sort of based on, and Nancy Garcia Lorza, who wrote Brava.
Right.
You all three of you worked together in this room, working on both of them at the same time. Or you basically, I guess the three of you were trying to philosophically create this thing.
Right. Well, so the premise is that we think better and we create better when we do it with other people.
Sure.
Especially if they're not like us. And if that's the premise, then it just felt to me, because, you know, I can be sort of literal-minded sometimes, then we should just apply that everywhere. So we apply it in the way we think about who is going to be in the audience to talk about these things, and we apply it in the way that the scripts got written. And so Nate and Nancy and I spent half a year together. Each of us had a project that we were the lead writer on. But it just felt to me that, well, if the three of us are doing the same thing and we're all trying to figure out the best way to create an audio story, which is a relatively unusual way to write a play,
no question.
Then why don't we have the benefit of each other's insights? You know, we'll learn this together. We'll make each other better. My adaptation of The Lost Books was developed that way, in part because I wanted, in a sense, to test the machine on myself to make sure I wasn't putting them through some like horrendous process.
Sure.
And it was fantastic. Like, I miss it. Like, you know, it was hard. It was hard work to like get these scripts right, but it was also like hilarious. You know, we laughed like crazy.
Oh,
we got really close. I remember, like, as we were wrapping up in the writer's room, it was time to go into production, just feeling like, you know, if the audiences have half as much fun with these things as we did in trying to figure them out together, we're going to be onto something here.
Well, and obviously you felt empowered enough or knowledgeable enough to go off on your own to do that third one, yes? Or was that part of this process too?
The Lost Books adaptation?
Yeah,
it was. I mean, you know, I had the incredible good fortune to spend 5 years on the artistic staff of the Public Theater when I lived in New York. And I was, you know, I spent those 5 years at the elbow of Oscar Eustace, my boss and friend, the artistic director, who, you know, is by... you know, acclamation, the best dramaturg in the world. And the dramaturg, for people who don't work in the theater, the dramaturg is the one who sits there and makes the plays better, gets the playwright to do their best work. And I got to watch him do that. And, you know, I feel very blessed to have gotten to do that. And I did think of part of my job as being to try to apply the things that I learned from Oscar in the service of Nate and Nancy's scripts and in the one that I was trying to do too.
I'm telling you, so far so good. Go to makebelieve.fm. Welcome back. Ernie Skatman is doing his best to provide bumps for this show, and I don't bring anything, but he's a great engineer. Got a few more minutes with Jeremy McCarter, author and head of the creator of something called the Make Believe Association, which now is a gathering of many, many Chicago talents into its first season of audio theatrical offerings at makebelieve.fm. One of the interesting things, Jeremy, about this first season, which has started with Brava and Bra Rabbit, two of the four shows of this first season, it goes, for me, to the kind of democratization of theater, because theater in this town, as many of us know, and anybody who goes to theater, is basically a very... I just saw a Chris Jones review where people are paying $95 to go see some crap show based on the television show Friends. And I'm saying that's not my idea of theater, but it is a mostly white, mostly moneyed crowd that goes to theater here. And that, though, if you have money and you are white, you can certainly enjoy everything at makebelieve.fm. But this is addressing the larger community that is Chicago.
Part of the reason to do it is to try to create a space where lots of different kinds of people are going to encounter each other. You know, I've been struck since I moved here by the, you know, there's the segregation that exists in the city.
No question.
And so if the stories are going to reflect the cultural kaleidoscope of Chicago, then how do we try to make that extend to the audience as well? And so what we ultimately came up with is, well, obviously we're not going to charge people to be in the live tapings. But then just stopping there, it doesn't really solve anything.
Right.
And so...
Yeah, that doesn't solve anything.
Yeah. And so what we do is then it just kind of... was this, you know, light bulb moment about a year ago. We just let the artists decide. So if the company of Brava, the Nancy Garcia Loza's incredible adaptation of this Mexican folktale about a brave girl who you know, journeys through a land of monsters. We just said to that cast and to Nancy and to the director, Laura Alcalá Baker, and to the, you know, who do you want to share this with? You decide. But also to my board, and also to, so that, you know, you get, because we are, what we're democratizing is the guest list.
Yeah.
And then when you have 15 people deciding who's going to be there, you end up with a room that doesn't look like the room that you just described, because when we are pulling from all of our social networks, the different corners of Chicago where all of us live, you know, I can't claim that we reflect, you know, the entirety, we can't reflect the entirety of Chicago, but we do reflect our Chicago.
Well, but the other thing is, the audience you're really getting, to my mind, is anybody who knows how to use a computer and can type makebelieve.fm.
Right.
That's the crowd.
There's that too, yeah. And it's also, and it is to say, you know, I just saw this study that made me really happy, that the demographics of podcast listening in America is now pretty close to the demographics of America.
Yeah, I could imagine.
Yeah.
I would imagine. Now, one of the other things I want to mention, that everybody, nobody does this for free. which you are not a nonprofit, and you do pay.
We are a nonprofit.
Okay, well, but you still, you're a nonprofit that will pay these actors and these engineers and these kids and people like Ernie to engineer these things.
We do. Yeah. Look, Make Believe is a nonprofit. Like, we exist entirely on the basis of foundations and individuals who are willing to make tax deductible contributions, which you can do at makebelieve.fm. But for me, I've been in the nonprofit world a long time, and I've seen how it works, that, you know, when people are doing something for reasons because they believe in the cause, that somehow then they don't need to eat.
Yeah.
That's false. And so from the very beginning, I told my board, that's not how this company is going to work. If we get the chance to build something from scratch, from the ground up, then we only get to have one set of ideals. And so if we're going to treat people with dignity, we're going to make artists feel that we respect the work that they do, then we're going to pay people. We're not going to have unpaid interns. We're going to use, you know, we're a SAG after a signatory, like, we, you know, and it makes the fundraising harder.
Sure.
But it also means you sleep slightly better at night because you feel like we're doing what we can to try to, you know, be as respectful of people and their time and their talent as we can be.
You, Bravo premiered, I think, and just after the start of the year, somewhere in early January.
Yeah.
What has been your reaction to the reaction to the podcast?
The reaction's been amazing. I mean, we're hearing from people all over the country who've been moved by it. We heard it, anyone who goes and listens to Brava,
as you should.
We had these beautiful conversations at the live tapings afterwards where women in particular were standing up and saying that this story is reminding them of someone in their family, yeah, someone that they know.
Yeah.
And that has continued, you know, now that it's out there in the world.
You do want to, obviously you want to. You want to hear from people. I mean, you would love to get emails and correspondence from people after they listen to this thing, because it's very hard. A lot of people, I listen to a podcast and that's gone and I'm gone.
Right. Yeah, sure. I mean, that channel is open. talk@makebelieve.fm is, you know, you can email us. You can reach out to us on Facebook or on Facebook too, Twitter. Yeah, Twitter. Do people really talk on Twitter?
No.
Not really. Yeah.
Not really. No.
Not really. But we want to hear from people. And we also, and like I said, like, we're, the most exciting thing to us is people who want to, like, listen with other people who feel like it's not just going to live on the internet. They're going to take it off the internet.
You amaze me on a number of levels, in that, especially in the fact that you have a recently born child and another child who's not much older than recently born. How do you find the time?
Powerful drugs. That's how I do it. No, I'm kidding. It's hard. It's not easy. You know, it's to find the time to try to have my family responsibilities and be running a startup.
Yeah.
But
you don't seem anywhere near as tired or frazzled as you did when you were finishing your second book, Young Radicals. You were really frazzled then.
Rick, you have the baseline of my...
I do.
Yeah, my poor time management.
I'm as official a biographer whenever he gets around to making that short. But this, it also seems it's a good indication how excited you are by this and how energized.
I mean, yeah, like Nate Marshall, Nancy Garcia Loza, these actors, like, I love working with these people and I love the work. Like, this is a crazy series of experiments to make this season happen, and it is happening, and the reception has been great. And, you know, to be honest, if we were taking big swings and missing, maybe it'd be harder, you know, to be getting by on not quite enough sleep. But it's been a blast.
Well, I must tell you, the first two that I've heard, the first two that are up and posted, Brava and Burrow Rabbit, are really remarkable achievements. I listened to them both about two or three times, and I could envision them on a stage, but the joy and pleasure of listening to them just by myself, not with a crowd, immense pleasure and fun. When's the third one? When's yours come out?
Lost Books of the Odyssey will be out end of this month.
And the masterpiece of Lorraine Hansberry.
Then What Use Are Flowers will be middle of March. That'll be the big finale.
All right, I'll have you back on. We can come back on and talk some more about it after it's all
done. I would love to talk with you about that Hansberry project.
Me
it's
too.
Amazing.
She just fascinates me. Just fascinates me. Dead at, I don't know, 38?
34.
Yeah. My mind hasn't completely gone. Go to makebelieve.fm.
Or anywhere podcast, anywhere, yeah, just, if you're a podcast listener, we're on every platform.
Every platform. Yep. No kidding. Just go to Make Believe FM.
The Make Believe Podcast.
Or Google. Jeremy and I are not the greatest computer people. I think if you just Google Make Believe Plays, you'll get something.
Who knows, right? I can vouch for this. If you go to Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or anywhere you go to and you search for Make Believe, you will find us. You can subscribe, and then you'll get Lost Books as soon as it arrives.
Great to see you, Jeremy.
It's great to see you, Rick.
Congratulations.
Thanks
so much.
It's
a bold, wonderful, wonderful thing. 600,000 podcasts, and this is among the top 10 already. I'll tell you that right now. And we'll take a little break, and then Catherine O'Connell will be in here to tell us. This is her busy time of year.
Old Ellis Island was swarming like a scene from a costume ball, decked out in the colors of Europe, on fire with the hope of it all. My father's own father.
I have a lovely guest in the studio. Whose voice is that?
With the tide.
Who is that?
Me?
Catherine O'Connell, you may be the most frequent guest. In the many years I've been doing this show, you may be on more than I've been on. You're such a great singer.
Thank you so much.
Catherine O'Connell, this is her busy, busy time of year. She will actually be on this show in a couple weeks with our mutual buddy Mary Pat Kelly, with whom you have formed a sort of, the duet.
Yeah.
Haven't you?
It's so much fun. And sadly, the woman that put us together, Peg Reed, who was the librarian at the Irish American Heritage Center, died. And so I get to sing her funeral.
How did you and Mary, before we get into all the stuff you're doing, which includes a March 2nd event at Moraine Valley Community College, how did you and Mary Pat get to, you must listen, I think you're on 2 weeks from tonight.
Correct.
With Mary Pat talking, it's like an Irish fest. It's like a pre-St. Patrick's Day bash. How did the two of you ever get together?
Mary Pat thought that it would be good to have a singer when she talked about her first book, Galway Bay. And she was coming to Chicago and talked to Peg Reed, the librarian, and she suggested me. So Mary Pat and I met on the steps of the Irish American Heritage Center.
I knew that was your first event together.
Right, and put our little set together. And we've had so much fun doing it. She's such a fabulous storyteller. And
with deep, deep Chicago roots, too.
Right,
that's the thing
right.
that distinguishes her novels. Deep roots. How's everything with you, dear?
Everything's great. Thank you so much.
Do you get worried or do you get anxious around this time of year? She is also, as I have noted in a number of columns, a former St. Patrick's Day parade queen, which carries with it huge responsibilities like going to lunch every year. Right?
Yeah. Exactly. So one of the things we're doing is Sheemsa na Gael for Old St. Pat's, and that's on the 12th, and then the Old Queen's or Former Queen's Lunch is is on the 13th. So I think I'll probably stay downtown.
It is like being in the Marine Corps. It's like once a queen, always a queen. Right?
It is. And it's so much fun. And the girl's like, so this is our last teen queen because it's 2019.
Wow.
So the next group will be the 20-somethings.
How many, not to be indelicate or
first one indelicate. Was 1956.
How many living queens are there now, roughly?
I would have to say there's got to be 45, maybe 50, even more. But not that many of them are involved at all.
Or still live in Chicago.
Right, right.
Are any of them, as you know, in jail or anything?
Nobody's in prison.
They're not like aldermen or something, are they? You used to, as a young woman, sing in smoky clubs and rock bands and all that stuff.
You did
all that. Do you miss that ever?
Do you know, now that they're not so smoky, I do miss I do miss the performance and that fun. It was a fun job.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, and then what you did, Catherine, is you left the world of showbiz in order to have family.
Right.
That pulled you away for a long time, didn't it?
Yeah, but I was lucky because I was able to make a transition to sing in church. And it's, I know it's crazy, from bar rooms to churches, but it really kept me busy. I got involved at Old St. Pat's, and I was able to sing with the choir and then be a cantor, a soloist, and tons of weddings, and then, you know, and lots of funerals and stuff like that. So it was an odd transition, but it was good. You know, you get dressed up. As a mom of three boys, I could get dressed up and go out to work and get nice compliments. And then, you know.
And it would be safe.
Right.
It would be safe for you.
Come home and be treated like crap. So whatever.
One of the things is about you, and we've talked about this before, because you and I have talked about everything, is that there is a different kind of emotional mindset that anybody attending a wedding has that differs vastly from anyone attending a funeral. Since you have to, in essence, perform at both these things, how do you adjust, honey?
You know, I'm not sure it's very, very different for me, because I just have to connect and with them and hope that my voice will give comfort, bring joy, whatever that's what I hope for.
Yeah.
You know, I find as I go along, and I'm at some churches where they don't let you do this, or they really want you to do that, or you know, stuff like that. And I just think, do nothing to add to their pain or lessen their joy.
Mm. Well, that's very well put. You must enjoy doing weddings much more than funerals, but...
Oh, no, I always say at the funerals, there's one less complainer.
Is that really? That's new. That's a new one of yours. It's a new one of yours. At these things, are you allowed, you have such a sort of strong repertoire, some of your own stuff and a lot of stuff on CD, and you can go to Catherine O'Connell, .com to see some of those. I don't know if you can still buy your CDs on...
Yeah, you can still buy CDs.
Good.
Yes, there. I have them in my basement, in fact, so just give me a call.
Where else? I mean, one of the other things about your career is the way in which the music business has changed. I mean, my goodness.
Right, I know.
I mean, everything is now a stream, and I know you put these CDs together to have a kind of narrative force.
Right.
One song would follow another for a specific reason.
And that was the toughest part. I mean, choosing the music was one big step, and then putting it in order on the CD that took hours and all kinds of thought and stuff. And now people just, it's like, you know, cafeteria. They'll just pick what they want, and that's it.
Before we get to in the next half hour, you're staying all the way till 10:30, and then we will have someone walk you back to your car, because it's slippery outside, isn't it?
Poor Catherine, like, so graceful.
It took like a little dip in front of the Hyatt, and wound up meeting a bunch of guys, right? It was like, I feel bad about that.
And they were all laughing.
Were they really?
No, they were not. They were very gentlemanly.
Did they come and help? Did mm-hmm. one rush to your aid?
Well, I don't know if they rushed, but, you know, once they saw that I wasn't unconscious, they thought maybe.
When someone is getting married and when someone has died, who picks the music? Do they pick the music, or is it a kind of creative collaboration with you?
I try to find out if they have some songs that they really want to have, and work around it with them. So it is collaborative.
And both events.
Right, right.
And marriages, too. You've done a number of those, have you not?
I have done those.
You marry them and bury them, and what was the other thing?
Yeah, the Irish priest that said, if you throw in a baptism, you're hatching, matching, and dispatching.
This is a terribly busy time of year for you, and we will get to every single thing that Catherine O'Connell does after the news. So please stay tuned. You'll hear some more of her beautiful, beautiful singing. One last question. You're getting better as a singer, aren't you?
Oh, thank you. No, I have to work a lot better, a lot more to produce the same song.
Okay.
Because
Well, you're nothing. You're falling down on wax. Stay tuned. More of Catherine O'Connell.
The fears and the fall.
Welcome back to After Hours with me, Rick Kogan, and that beautiful, beautiful songbird, Catherine O'Connell. You really do have an astonishing voice, and I'm not the only person to say that. I know you know, the Daly family, for instance, is... You think he's going to be... Catherine Thank doesn't you. Vote in Chicago unless yeah. she has some special dispensation we don't know about. You think there's going to be another Daly for mayor? You know that family pretty well, which doesn't mean you would know who's going to be the next mayor, but...
I definitely think he'll make the runoff.
I don't think there's any question.
Right.
And it's really pretty amazing. Right. You had the chore of singing at a number of events for the Daly family, but more to the point... On March 2nd, you will be a part of an evening of Irish music and song, along with the Moraine Valley Chamber Singers, the great Catherine Keane, the astonishing Jimmy Moore. What is that event? Tell me about that. Give me the details.
It's so much fun.
It's at the college, Moraine Valley.
And they have a wonderful theater there. Just wonderful. I think it's 650 seats, maybe
wow.
700. And it's a beautiful facility. It really is. And
have you done this before? And I just...
Right. This is my third year. So Kathleen Keene and I did it 3 years ago. Jimmy Moore came last year. And so it's Jimmy Moore, Kathleen Keene and I with a small orchestra, a small ensemble orchestra, and a chorale at about 50 singers.
What kind of, I'm assuming some traditional Irish songs, but is there a themed, musical theme to the evening?
It's Irish, and so they'll do choral arrangements of some, I think, The Spinning Wheel, and Will You Go, Lassie Go, and a couple of others, you know, and then we have a little sing-along at the end of the night with Irish Eyes Are Smiling, and everybody sings along, and it is just so much fun.
Who does it attract? I mean, obviously people from that area, but I would think people way beyond that.
Well, it does.
Fans of yours, right, certainly.
Right, but they have a real strong box office for this, a real strong following for the whole chorale series. The conductor is so, Nick Thomas is so much fun, and he's just delightful, and he's a great conductor, and they all, you know, they sound wonderful, great blend and everything like that. Plus, he's also a character, and he wears some funny hats and things like that. And everybody just is relaxed and enjoys it, and it's really lots of fun.
Now, is obviously for the last 3 years been the sort of... lighting the fuse for the busiest month of your life, right?
It is pretty busy. And really, things have really stacked up this year, too, to be just basically for about 2 weeks of real busyness.
And what do you do? What do you do, Catherine O'Connell, on St. Patrick's Day?
Well, St. Patrick's
Traditionally,
Day.
Traditionally, what have you done?
The St. Patrick's Day parade is the Saturday before St. Patrick's Day. So I'll ride in the parade with the old queens.
Uh-huh.
and then we'll, you know, generally we'll go out for a little while after that. And then St. Patrick's Day, unless I really get up and get down to the South Side early, that's where the South Side parade is on St. Patrick's Day this year.
Oh, it is. It is.
So unless I get down there really early, like, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning, they start blocking the streets off near where my family lives and stuff. So,
does it ever bug you? I think I've had our mutual friend Father Cusick on talking about this. That you know, this whole "Kiss Me, I'm Irish" nonsense and the whole the party atmosphere that has seems to have increasingly taken over the. What was always a very pretty religious holiday, for Christ's sake,
well,
so to speak.
That's the genesis of Seamsa na Gael. I mean, there's so much beautiful literature and music and everything like that.
Yeah.
That needs to be celebrated and stuff like that.
Well, I think in a place like, you're going to be with Mary Pat Kelly at the Irish American Heritage Center, I think that, you know, I know a lot of people like to go up there on St. Patrick's Day or whatever St. Patrick's Day is happening and blah, blah, blah. It's a lovely place to go at some other time of year.
Right, right, right. And they offer a lot of dance and a lot of
culture,
music and stuff.
And art.
And they have that wonderful library.
Yeah, yeah, and they have that nice bar.
Really nice bar.
Mm-hmm. With music. It always sort of, the fact that, for less than, you know, green beer, shamrock shakes, with all due respect to those of you who like them out there, and the whole, you know, I did, even the dyeing of the river green, as cool as it looks, and it would look incredibly cool from up here.
Wait,
would it
you
not,
guys are
going to
love that. Oh, yeah, my gosh.
Yeah, we should sell tickets to the
Absolutely.
Windows up here. Absolutely. So this evening of Irish music, you can go to Catherine's website where there is a link to how to get tickets to this thing. It's on your website on CatherineO'Connell.com. It's also, I tell you what the website is here, but it's so long that you'd never write it down. You're sleepy. Or if you just Google, seriously, the best way to get it, you have a link on your website.
Correct.
So go to CatherineO'Connell.com and link to this thing and then order some of her CDs, too. You do have... How many CDs do you have?
I have 4 altogether.
Is that it?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. My favorite may be Songs from My Father.
I know. I love that one, too.
Why?
Because I did really channel my dad a lot while we were making it. But the Christmas one we made... I finished it right after my mom died, and my sisters came into the studio, and we did Angels We've Heard on High, and that's the 4 of us singing, and that would be, I think that, you know, would have made my mom really proud.
Yeah, I'll bet. Catherine.
My mom, the big actress.
That's right. Catherine tearing up in the studio. We'll take a short little break. We'll hear some more music, and we'll talk about the 4 events she has with Mary Pat Kelly this month coming up, and also about Chimpson. You will hear Mary Pat Kelly on the radio. What did we figure out? Is it next weekend? It's either 2 weeks from tonight. She will be on with Mary Pat Kelly, and we'll make fun of Mary Pat Kelly. And then the Chimpson of Yale, which I have learned to pronounce after 15 years of mispronouncing it. That's on March 12th. We'll be back in a couple minutes.
Now, 'twas there I learned reading and writing, at Ballymartin, where I went to school. It was there I learned howling and fighting from my schoolmaster, Mr. O'Toole. Him and me, we had many a scrimmage, and divil a copy I wrote, till I lathered him with my shillelagh, for he tread on the tail of my mush, 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 turrilladdy. My mush, 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 turrilladdy.
That is such, welcome back. That is such a great song, Catherine O'Connell.
Thank you.
I don't know if you'll hear that at Moraine Valley Community College, an evening of Irish music and song. What is the difference between Irish music and song? Do you mean instrumental and singing, or what?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Right.
You know, genius that I am. Then that is, man, are you busy the next couple of weeks? Mary Pat Kelly, talking about her latest book, Irish Above All. You two will be on March 3rd from 1 to 3. March 3rd being a Sunday?
Sunday afternoon,
perfect time at the Irish American Heritage Center on the Northwest Side. That is a lovely place. We have talked about that. You will vary this show. You know, one of the great things about the two of you, never having seen this show, but knowing the two of you pretty well, is you're not going to get, you could go to all 4 of these things and you get a variation of a show. I mean, I'm sure you have some songs you want to sing, but it could change at a moment's notice, couldn't it?
Right. Because she has so many relations, you know, she'll say, oh, so-and-so is here, my cousin is here, could you sing, you know, I'll Take You Home Again, Kathleen. Okay, whatever, if that works.
Her book, Galway Bay, was, I think that may have been her first book, wasn't it?
And it was the first book in this trilogy. Her first book was when she was the nun.
The nun. Right. I don't remember the name of it. It doesn't matter. But Galway Bay is the one that really sort of exploded. I think Dave Sambert, the Polo Cafe, sold 8 million copies there alone. Then you'll be March 4th at 7 p.m. at the Orland Park Library, which is really one of my favorite libraries. You've been there before.
We did, yeah.
Isn't that a great place? And the crowds are fantastic.
They were wonderful to us. Yeah, we had a great time there. I think that was 2 years ago with Of Irish Blood.
Oh, right, Of Irish Blood. That's the other one. Then it's a luncheon event on March 8th, 11:30 to 1:30 at the Union League Club. That is open to the public, I would think.
It is. It is. And it was so much fun last year. We just... We build it more Wild Irish Women, and and that seemed to bring out some lovely people. Really fun. Lots of, but actually, we have quite a few cousins there and stuff. So it was a lot of fun.
I'm going to give you the phone number for that one, ladies and gentlemen. You don't need, you know, Orland Park Library. You find it, go there at 7 o'clock on the 4th. The 4th also being the anniversary, the birthday of the city of Chicago, even though you'll be in Orland Park. Union League Club is 312-427-7800, and they really do. I don't know what the price is, but usually at these book events, the book is included with it. It may not be this time, I don't know, but it's nice food and a good lunch.
Correct.
And how does it work? Well, you two talk for a while, or Mary Pat tells
the
story?
Because
I cannot imagine two more ebullient people up there, and then you just say, well, why don't you sing a song, Catherine? Like that.
No, she likes to weave the songs into her narrative.
She?
Yeah.
Does she?
Yeah, and so it's really... People find it very touching and you know, interesting and stuff. It's a lot of fun.
So it's not as crazy spontaneous, and it's probably spontaneous, but not as spontaneous as I'm making it out to be, right?
Right. And, you know, so she knows sometimes she has to rein it in and let somebody else make a sound.
Yeah. She's a good talker. She'll be on.
She's so much fun, and she's such a brilliant storyteller.
Yeah. She's done well with these books. Then on March 10th, the bookstall in Winnetka, which is one of the great independent bookstores in this country. It used to be run by a woman, so it was started and run by a woman named Roberta Rubin. And it's sort of the ultimate bookstore to my mind.
Yeah, it's great. And we did we did another one there, again, 2 years ago, the same time we did. And we just had such a great response and nice group of people there. And
book buyers, too.
Book buyers, oh, yeah. And,
Do you bring CDs to the shows?
I do.
Good.
Right. Maggie Kelly Crane is she's reading Irish Above All now. She said my name's in that book, so I can't wait
to see her.
I haven't read it yet. And anyway, she's somehow related to Mayor Kelly too. So she's maybe some really far-off cousin to Mary Pat Kelly.
Well, who isn't? I'm probably a far-off cousin to Mary Pat Kelly. We have a few extra minutes. What name a song? Ernie and I are getting so into your music now. You brought some CDs. Name a song. What do you want to hear 3 minutes of, Catherine?
3 minutes?
Yeah.
Oy, 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 oy.
2 minutes. Three. 4 minutes. What do you want to hear?
Let's see. Well, for Shimsa, I'm doing IRIs today, The Deer's Cry, but that's kind of, it's very, very Christian.
So?
Very religious.
Well, it doesn't...
But I think it's really, really a wonderful song, and we're going to be doing that at...
What CD is it?
It's on the...
IRIs Today. It's on the air. It's a title track.
And it's called The Deer's Cry, number one, I think.
The Deer's Cry, number one. You got it, Ernie, or no? Play anything you want. We love her music, and Ernie and I will dance to it.
That's too cute.
I arise today.
Thanks. Sorry for that. Oh, I love this song.
I do too.
Yeah.
Light of sun, radiance of moon.
Now, do you still have to...
Splendor of fire. Speed of lightning. Swiftness of wind. Depth of the sea. Stability of earth. Firmness of rock. Today, through God's strength to pilot me, God's eye to look beyond.
His wisdom to guide me, God's way to lie before me, God's shield to...
See, I don't know what religion is in a song or not in a song. That's just a beautiful voice. Do you still have to practice? I mean,
oh, yeah.
What do you do for your voice? You have to take, I mean, it's a valued instrument. How do you take care of it?
I find that I can't go out and hang in the bars like I used to. My voice hasn't gone
nobody
back.
Can. I can't do it either. I don't even sing.
But it's so loud, and you have to talk so loud in bars now. And it's just, I can't do it anymore. So I miss a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And you know me. I like to be in there for the party.
That's true, honey. That's true. But do you have to practice?
Yeah, I do practice and rehearse and vocalize every day. Every day.
For how long?
Usually my whatever, however long it takes me to get to wherever I'm going.
Have you ever, honey, have you ever lost your voice? Have you ever sort of sung yourself out? I was talking to somebody about a month ago who told me that somewhere along the line they like lost their voice and they were just so terrified. Not of speaking, but they can still speak, but they were unable to sing any longer.
That's a big fear for any singer.
Sure.
But I had I had this little teacher when I first started, and her name was Lisa Paul, and she lived over on Pine Grove, and I'd go there for a lesson, and she really, really beat it in, you know, to you know, to keep your voice in front. Don't you know what's up, you know, and stuff like that. Keep your voice up in front, especially when you're singing. And honestly, you know, there were years there where I would start with Mass at Old St. Pat's on St. Patrick's Day, sing all day long until the bars closed at 1 or 2 or whatever time, and still be able to sing. And I truly believe it was that training that helped me.
Do you think there's another CD in you, or is the music business just too nutty to... I don't even know anybody who makes CDs anymore, frankly.
Well, there's still people like Katie Grennan. She just came out with one. I know Liz Carroll.
Yeah.
You know, they're still people. My friend Pauline Keneally, banjo, you know, it's sure. Wonderful. So there's people, you know, I try to, but it's... I have to get some more money together to do it.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, buy her CDs and also go to all of these events she has. Catherine O'Connell, which you can find at CatherineO'Connell.com, O'Connell with no apostrophe, will be on here 2 weeks from tonight with the one and only Mary Pat Kelly, and good Lord, are we going to give her a hard time. Catherine, it's great to see you. Don't knock yourself out here. Go to her website to get in on this, an evening of Irish music and song at Moraine Valley Community College. It sounds like a blast.
And don't forget Sheems and a Gael on the 12th, March 12th. It's so much fun.
Yes, and we will promote that
All right.
In 2 weeks when you're on with
I know,
Mary
but
Pat
if you want to get good seats.
Well, that's true. Sheems and a Gael. Just go to Catherine's website, buy her CDs so she can make another CD. Stay tuned. We're talking about a very, very interesting novel by an old Chicagoan. Now, he's not that old, but he's a former Chicago named Lenny Kleinfeld. You may remember that name. Welcome back to the final portion of After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. I am hoping that some of you may remember the name, if not from his two previous novels. You're going to remember it after you read Shooting Lessons, the third from Lenny Kleinfeld. Lenny, how are you? How's the weather in Los Angeles?
Sunny during the day. It's springtime in California, Southern California.
I just asked you that to make me feel lousy. It's great to talk to you. This is your third. I think we've talked about. I know I had you on the air to talk about Some Dead Genius before, But yeah, I want to talk just for 5 minutes about your Chicago years, where you were a playwright, you were a columnist for Chicago Magazine, because I know a lot of people remember your name. You cut a pretty big swath there.
Well, thank you. Well, at least in the theater community, I was lucky enough to be around during the early 70s, and the whole also professional theater scene was busy giving birth to itself.
Yeah. Who'd you work with? I saw it on Facebook, and I never, Lenny, I never go on Facebook, and I saw on Facebook a note from Bob Falls saying, hey, I wish I could listen to you on Rick's show. How can I do this?
Bob, when Bob was running Wisdom Bridge Theater, he had the misfortune to produce one of my really bad scripts. I started in Chicago with Stuart Gordon.
Sure.
We had met at college at the University of Wisconsin. And then he started The Organic, and I got a call from him one night who said, asking if I wanted to write a trilogy of science fiction plays. And I said, yeah, sure, why not?
Yeah, why not?
And that was Warp.
Warp.
Ask your grandparents about it, they'll remember.
Hey, I remember. What are you kidding? Yes, you listeners out there, ask your grandparents. That was, I mean, it's hard. It's not hard to remember what, it's hard for some people to remember what a huge, huge hit that was and how unbelievably successful for a time until Stewart kind of got lured to Hollywood, how important that the Organic Theater Company was at the time.
Yeah, well, it was one of the first companies that turned professional and paid a salary.
Yeah,
and did a lot of original work.
Yeah.
And also, it helped that Stewart was one of the most incredibly creative and funny directors who's ever walked the earth.
Yeah.
That's always an ace in the hole there.
Now, what lured you out? When did you leave Chicago, Lenny?
That happened in 1986.
Wow.
I arrived in 72. Actually 71, when the first Mayor Daley was still in office,
mm-hmm.
and I left in 86, and that was so long ago there were still payphones at O'Hare that would cut you off after 3 minutes. Like everybody else in the theater scene, you sort of doing good work and having a great time is plenty till you're about 30, and then your body starts wanting more money.
Well, and your brain starts wanting to say, "I think I need things like health insurance," and I think
that always helps. And everybody I know was either doing TV or movies or moved onto theater in New York. And I wrote a screenplay, and the night I finished it, I got a call from Michael Douglas's director of development. Stewart had given her my name; they were looking for somebody to adapt the novel.
Oh.
I didn't get the novel gig, but he liked the screenplay and bought it. So suddenly, two days later, I was in the movie business.
Well, just and you've been in the movie business sort of on and off ever since, have you not?
Well, no. I had a 3.2 near career. It was sort of like near beer. I worked very steadily for 15 years. I sold about half a dozen screenplays, and not one of them ever got shot.
You know, that's something that people, I know another person who, and I know a number of people who've done that, that the number of movies to screenplays written for movies is about, 5%, wouldn't you say? There are...
Yeah, they generate a ton of product and scripts, and then they shoot a very small percentage of them.
Well, but
it's an industrial process, basically.
But also, you can hone your craft, though, as a screenwriter because you're paid. One is paid, or used to be, I suppose, fairly well for that kind of thing.
More than off-loop theater? Yeah.
Yeah. Did you enjoy the craft of screenwriting?
Yes, I did. I knew how to write a script, but it also is much more concise because you've got a camera,
yeah.
And that eliminates the need for thousands of words.
Right, right. And so one of the nice things about this book, too, and I really want to get into shooting lessons, because it does involve shooting, and it does involve... there's a famous... I just want to tell you this, Lenny Kleinfeld, because we kind of know each other. There's a famous story written by a man named... I can't remember his name, but it was called Killing Santa Claus, where some mad killer goes out before Christmas and kills a bunch of Santa Clauses. And not that you borrowed from that, but in your book, in the new book, Shooting Lessons, what is happening in Chicago is the murder of drivers. Yes?
Yeah, somebody's murdering the drivers of a very large ride-hail company.
I'm going to read this, and I think that you don't mind if I read from your book, do you?
Oh, I'm terrible at it. I wish you would be the one to do this, yes.
Well, here's a portion of it. The media had been in serial killer heat since the news of one man's murder broke. The perp had been dubbed the Macro being the name of the company, the Macro Killer, which inspired a deluge of speculation and memes about whether that moonwalker wasn't his only job description. It was a prediction about what he'd do to the macro empire. CNN was playing clips of two Chicago macro drivers who said they were going on hiatus until the macro killer was forced, or maybe forever. Live in the studio, the anchor and anecdotal evidence indicated, quote, dozens, end quote, of macro drivers in Chicago were doing... This sounds so like TV, Lenny Kleinfeld. You so captured this. We're doing the same, and so were, quote, an unknown number, end quote, around the country. Macro claimed it was only a, quote, handful, end quote. Rival ride-hail apps claim they were getting hundreds of applications from macro drivers. It's a fascinating premise that we're going to explore. Also, I'm so taken with this Mark Bergman, a cop in the book. How long did it take you to write this, Lenny? Because I have some vague feeling that it's been a few years since we talked.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This took a good 3.5 years. I started a book number 3 that, you know, same two cops who were in the first two books.
Yeah.
And I was about 75 or 80 pages into it, and it just wasn't working.
Oh.
So that just, you know, throw that one out the window, and I had to start all over and come up with a whole nother idea for a book, and then you have to sort of outline it to convince yourself it's going to work, and then you get it finished, and it says, hey, you got to rewrite me another couple of times before you can, you know, unleash this on the public.
Well, I'm going to ask you, when we come back from a very short commercial break, I want to ask you the difference between, there's something very, very cinematic about this book, about your latest novel, Shooting Lessons. And I want to ask you, so mull it over, the differences between writing a play or a screenplay and a novel. We will be right back. Welcome back. If you are looking for a good, entertaining, knowing, funny, suspenseful read, Shooting Lessons by Lenny Kleinfeld is that book. It is under the large umbrella of crime fiction, and it involves a person who is out killing the drivers for a rideshare company called Macro. One of the first drivers to go happens to be Lenny, and I don't take this personally, a former Tribune reporter who left being downsized.
He's the second person to
yes.
get killed. I knock off an
actor. Oh, the
first.
Second, you're right, the
so
second
the first
one.
First to die is from my tribe, not yours.
The second one is a reporter. I love it. I love it. I love it. The book is written, I said it was very cinematic. In that it comes at you with great, great force, and I think part of that is the short, the chapters are quite short, and I'm not saying half a page, though I think one or two are.
Oh, are, yeah. Well, I think that's something I picked up from writing screenplays. Both on the stage and the screen, time is very ruthless. You have to be incredibly efficient. And with camera, you need much less language in the movies because the camera can do a lot of the work. There are close-ups, there's the long shots of storytelling. Whereas with a book, the reader controls the flow of time. They can read at their own pace, they can stop, they can reread, they can walk away and come back and pick it up. So you have a little bit more leisure with that. But what I did learn is that you can do contrapuntal storylines in a book very similarly to the way you do it in a movie. For instance, in this book, we've got the serial killer who's knocking off the ride-hail drivers simultaneously with a very large, powerful gun lobbying organization who's mounting a very flashy, expensive
campaign, for everybody. Everybody
to lift all handgun restrictions in Illinois.
Yeah,
and that allows me to bounce back and forth between the two stories and, you know, gradually merge them.
Well, that thing makes it, I mean, it's a campaign to have everybody allowed to have conceal and carry, which
yeah.
just, which gives me the chills on the very face of it, but it also makes this book incredibly topical, I think, and I hear, and you have a wonderful way of drawing characters, too, among the most interesting in the book, because the former Tribune reporter named Gold dies pretty quickly in the book. Your detective, Mark Bergman, is you really, really capture him here in this one graph, if I can read it. You write, Lenny Kleinfeld writes, 6 months ago, while hunting a serial killer nicknamed Art Critic, Mark took down a gangster and two mercenaries who were trying to eliminate a witness. The four notches on Mark's gun, combined with Mark being single, smart, and not ugly, put him on screens across America and beyond, which made him Superintendent of Police Gary Shook's favorite public relations toy. The Soup personally donated Mark to the Bachelor Auction, a fundraiser hosted by the wife of the alderman who chaired the city's budget committee. You still, I don't know if you revisit Chicago all the time or keep tabs
all
on
the time.
Yeah, well, good, because that really captured, that is, to my mind, I go, yeah, that could happen, that could absolutely, that could absolutely happen tomorrow if it hasn't already happened today. You must be, what drew you, Lenny, from, it drew you to novel writing, because I've read them all, and this one, Shooting Lessons, is, I'm not going to say it's more accomplished than the others, but it's a more forceful book. Let me put it that way. What drew you to novel writing in the first place?
Well, I don't know what it means in the rest of the country, but in Los Angeles, the term first-time novelist is actually a Latin phrase meaning unemployed screenwriter over the age of 50. I mean, I had to write something
yeah.
at that point in my career when people stopped buying screenplays
sure.
to read and not produce.
Uh-huh.
And I've always liked reading crime fiction.
Sure.
And you like any art form, you imitate stuff that you like and hope that you can do something that other people will like.
All right, this being number 1, 2, 3 in your novel career, do you feel, is it easier? I mean, obviously this one wasn't. If you wrote so many pages of something and tossed it away, but this book just feels so much more self-assured. Am I making too much of that, Lenny Kleinfeld, or not?
No, I think after 3 books, I'm finally getting slightly better at it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not writing as quickly as I did when I was young, but you get better at something with practice, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Except maybe golf. Practice doesn't seem to help most people I know who play that game.
Well, I also love the fact, I mean, I love many things about your oeuvre, as I'll now call it. You still have an incredible sense of this city, and I think you obviously feel so comfortable writing about Chicago, don't you?
I arrived in Chicago at the age of 20 and fell in love with it. The city welcomed me, and I married a girl from Chicago, and my friends in theater that I met in Madison were many of them were Chicagoans, like Stuart.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say the most intense and interesting 15 years of my life, possibly, at least professionally, were spent in Chicago. And I just think it's the best American city. And nothing that's happened in the years since I've left it has done anything to change that opinion.
Have you gotten movie nibbles from your novels?
Not one.
That's astonishing to me.
One can only hope. Actually, I think the 3 books are almost, each one stands alone, but it's almost one long story. You know, it's the
yeah.
same 2 guys, and
interesting.
It does progress chronologically. I would think that if I had my druthers and my dreams about this came true, it would be like a cable TV series where
yeah.
You could do each book could get 8 or 10 episodes instead of squeezing it into 90 minutes apiece.
Well, from your lips to some smart producer's ears, are you working on something new now?
No, I'm just you know, rinsing my brain with wine and waiting to get to the launch of this book, and then I'll, you know, resume thinking about what I'm going to do when I grow up.
Yeah, who isn't? Who isn't? I also love, Lenny Kleinfeld, that you dedicated this book to Sheldon Patinkin, who was... I cannot read one of Sheldon's philosophies as it is captured on the dedication page, but you do, you call him a writer, director, professor, and loving uncle to four decades of the Chicago theater people. Lenny, it's great to talk to you, and I got to tell you, it's even more fun to read you. I really love this book.
Oh, thank you, and I really appreciate how you've, for decades, gotten behind any Chicagoan who did something you thought was worthwhile.
Well, thank you.
And I'm honored to be.
Oh, that's very sweet of you. But thank you for saying that. I thought you were going to say for any Chicagoan. I am more discriminating. The older I get, the more discriminating I get. And someone will call and say, like, did you read my book? And I go, uh-huh. Can I be on the radio? I go, and I literally, if they don't live here, I'll lie to them and say, well, I don't have a radio
well,
show.
Well, I'm Andre DeShields, the great organic theater actor who you
oh,
had a
sure.
on Broadway.
Sure.
Andre's line that he's had since college for handling what happens when you go see somebody in a play and they're terrible and you have to go backstage and talk to them afterwards is to say, well, you've done it again.
Thank you for that. I will use that. Lenny, take care of yourself. Let me know the next time you're in town.
Absolutely.
The novel is Shooting Lessons. The name is Lenny Kleinfeld, KLEINFELD.com. So take care of yourself and enjoy the weather.
Thanks a lot.
Okay,
bye-bye.
My pleasure. Thank you all for listening. Ernie Skatton, you're the greatest engineer in the world. Ben Anderson, you're the greatest producer. Carla Mari is coming up, and I am going to slip and slide my way home and see you next Sunday.